Turncoat's Drum by Nicholas Carter and read by Paul McLaughlin for Saga Egmont. The English Civil War in the West, 1643. Prologue. Let peace be sought through war. Cromwell's personal motto. By the Palace of Westminster, London, April 1643. Sir Henry Vane, young Harry to noisy jostling backbenchers and sober-minded parliamentarian greybeards alike, paused at the massive studded door, stroked his large nose. He thought for a second, then rapped loudly and strode in. The room was large but barely lit. Screens had been carried in and positioned to make the most of the meagre fire flickering in the grate, entice the warmth from the gloomy corners. He had hurried from one end of London to the other that day, busy about Parliament's, and therefore the Lord's, work, and hadn't seen a decent flame yet. The people, shivering and snapping at one another, had been even more ill-mannered than usual. They had stared out of their sooty rooms and smoky alehouses with undisguised suspicion, whispered and muttered to their neighbours as he hurried along the filthy back streets. It was as if he had hung a forked tail from his black breeches. Parliament needed a victory, a clear-cut, decisive, unquestionable triumph to dispel the mood of gloomy uncertainty which pervaded the capital from the most magnificent townhouse to the meanest hovel. A buff-coated Caesar to march down Tower Hill, trailing 1,000 shackled prisoners, was what they needed now. A Hannibal who could humble these king's men, reduce their precious cavalry to a procession of peacocks dragging rusty chains. Then the people would find their voices once more. Harry was sure of it. Indeed, he dared not be sure of anything else. He snorted under his breath, tried to imagine which of their current commanders could deliver the spectacular success they craved. The Earl of Essex. Manchester. They were ponderous windbags, skillful enough strategists with pen and ink, but rather less forthcoming with guns and powder. They delivered fine speeches, but precious little in the way of action. In the meantime, London shivered, pondering its uncertain future. The capital without its king was like a road without an inn, a room without a fire. And there would be plenty more cold days and nights before this war was done, Vane reflected miserably, especially if the king's powerful forces in the north tightened their stranglehold on the capital's coal supplies. His increasingly active armies in the south had already begun to paralyze the wool trade up the Thames Valley, and the navy had its hands full sweeping sudden swarms of pirates from the seas. Trade, commerce, enterprise at home and abroad, the lifeblood of Parliament's cause, the self-made men who had heckled King Charles to distraction every time he had dared call a Parliament, who had drawn up their grand remonstrance in an attempt to shape this monumental mercantile movement to redefine their role in the running of the country, strangle trade, ruin the mighty merchants, and Parliament would be nothing but a shouting house of frightened men, their armies naked and unpaid, rotting around frozen campfires. Vane shivered involuntarily, straightened the collar of his plain but immaculately cut coat, and strode into the room with his usual jaunty confidence. Good young Harry, here to cheer us this misty evening. Three rigid armchairs had been pulled up close, the seats on either end occupied by a pair of black-suited men, bent over an assortment of papers and reports. Vane glanced behind the screen, saw a large map of England weighted down over a table, wooden blocks supporting colourful painted flags, a tiny trace of gaiety in the grim chamber. He nodded to the elder of the two gentlemen, who had glanced up to see what was keeping him.
"Harry, thank you for coming," he said, holding his stomach and climbing to his feet with a painful wince.
John Pym, leader of the house, was a portly but pale man of medium height, his grey hair brushed back in waves from his calm, intelligent face. Vane shook his hand, took the proffered chair, and nodded to the second man who returned the briefest of acknowledgements. Oliver St. John, brilliant lawyer and solicitor general, taciturn to the point of rudeness. Pym was the talker, the gifted diplomat who could stitch the most diverse political and clerical elements of the country into an easy alliance against their king. The unlikely triumvirate had lashed themselves to the rudder of Parliament's fortunes, and if ever again Charles Stuart marched into London a free man, there would be few ahead of them in the queue for the scaffold. Pym made himself comfortable.